live from the Mehewe Theater at the Berkshire International Film Festival in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. If you've ever spent time in the Berkshire Mountains during the late spring or summer, or the fall for that matter, you will get what I'm about to say. This may very well be one of the most perfect places on the planet. I'm biased, sure. I live in a town, Winsted, Connecticut, that is at the foothills of the Berkshires, and I feel the gravitational pull of this place all the time. It's not just the scenery, although that's pretty amazing, or the hiking or restaurants. It's the creativity that seems to be woven into every single acre. Mass MoCA, the Williamstown Theater Festival, Tanglewood, Edith Wharton's The Mount, the yoga mecca Kripalu, the Impressionists at the Clark. Literally a few minutes drive to more culture and art than you could possibly fit into one season. So today, Where We Live, we hit the road to spend some time in a place where so many residents of Connecticut and New York come every summer. We're here for the first time as part of the Berkshire International Film Festival, something that Colin McEnroe has been raving about and broadcasting from for years. Later this afternoon at 1 o'clock, we'll hear more from him as he talks with movie makers at the Triplex Cinema just down the block, one of the main hubs of activity for the festival. We're at one of the other hubs, the beautifully restored Mehewe Theater in downtown Great Barrington, which is one of my favorite towns in the whole world. Over the next hour, we'll hear from some of the area's rich cultural institutions, learn more about this year's exciting summer season in the Berkshires. We'll also learn about one of Great Barrington's most famous and influential natives, civil rights leader W.E.B. Du Bois. You can join the conversation. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us first here on stage at the Mehewe Theater is Ariel Block, interim co-artistic director, associate producer, manager of institutional giving at Shakespeare & Company. Ariel, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's Block.
Bach. Thank you very much. Mary Claire Holbert is Director of Marketing and Communication at the Jacobs Pellow Dance Festival. Hello there, Mary Claire.
Good morning.
And Jeremy Clough is Manager of Media Services at the Norman Rockwell Museum. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's see. There's so much to talk about, and I want to be able to talk a little bit about how all of your institutions work together. But first, let me just start with you, Errol, and talk a little bit about the history of Shakespeare & Company. This is one of the many institutions that's been around here for so many years. How did it get started?
Well, it got started when Tina Packer and a friend of hers, Mitch Berenson, happened upon Edith Wharton's estate, The Mount. Tina was looking for a place outside of New York City to start a theater company. And they loved The Mount. It was derelict at the time. No one was living in it. So they brought in a team of young actors who spent the summer there renovating and performing. They performed A Midsummer Night's Dream. And Tina also brought in a contingent of her British friends, actors. So it was kind of a multicultural effort. And it was in the outdoor estate, beautiful outdoor natural amphitheater. And that was 38 years ago.
Wow.
So since then, we've done Shakespeare plays, and we've moved to our own campus, which is just down the road from the Mount. We still perform at the Mount.
Which is now much less derelict, let's just say.
Much less derelict. It's completely beautiful. The gardens are all restored, and the house is restored. But we still, there's a little natural amphitheater, the Dell, which we use for our 90-minute Northeast Tour version, which is an outdoor experience for people.
We were talking about this before the show, and for many of the institutions here, especially that perform during the summer, things do happen all year round in the Berkshires, but much of what we're talking about happens in the summer. There is this kind of summer camp feel, and even what you were talking about, all these young actors from around the world coming together to build a place, mm-hmm. both in the work that they were doing, but actually literally physically build a place. Has that spirit maintained all these 38 years?
Oh, completely, yes. I think we, even though we now have a state-of-the-art shops and dormitories and office buildings and things like that, and two wonderful theaters, we still have a complete spirit of adventure. I mean, we're trying new technical things this year that we've never tried before. We have people coming from all over the country to perform in different shows, and it's a wonderful collaboration of both new people, new artists, and seasoned people. I mean, people like myself who've been here for, I hate to say it, 37 years. Almost the whole time.
Yeah.
Right. And other people who are brand new this year. It would be wonderful.
Now, obviously, you don't just perform Shakespeare's works, but I want to talk a little bit about Shakespeare and the way in which you try to keep this work alive in the work that you do. Shakespeare is, of course, all over the place in many ways. But at the same point, when you have a company focused on this work, how do you keep it fresh? How do you keep it alive? How do you draw people in, maybe people who have seen this work time and time again?
Well, we have a unique approach to the text. We believe that Shakespeare, first and foremost, was an actor. So it's an actor-driven approach, and we speak directly to the audience. We don't use microphones. And we explore the text in a way. Usually the first week of any rehearsal is about exploring the actor's personal relationship to the text. So that gives each production, no matter if it's the same show, like Midsummer Night's Dream, we've done several times, it gives each production a completely new a look and feel, depending on who the actors are and who the directors are.
And how much different is that than a company that, you know, works in a city and works in a very confining space? I mean, is there something about the space that you're in, the ability to experiment, if you will, over the course of time? Is there something different about the work you're putting on?
Well, I think there is. And I think that a lot of that is rooted in the fact that we performed initially for many, many years outdoors. There's nothing like saying Shakespeare's language and feeling the earth under your feet rather than the floor, and looking up and seeing the stars and the trees. And I think we still have that feeling as we perform, that we're still sort of part of nature, part of the natural world, and not kind of bound by a tiny space.
We're in the Berkshires today on Where We Live. We're broadcasting from the Berkshire International Film Festival. Colin McEnroe will be here later on this afternoon talking more about the movies, but we brought together some of the great cultural institutions from around the Berkshires. Ariel Bach is here. She's from Shakespeare and Company. I quickly have to ask you, many of our listeners probably saw a story in the New York Times about some controversy surrounding the theater company, mostly just having to do with a bunch of resignations or changes at the top. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about what has changed about the company? What has maintained about the company? if you've been reading that, people might go, oh my goodness, are they in trouble?
Oh, no, actually we're not in trouble at all. We in financial terms, we're doing really great. We have our box office is ahead of last year.
That's good to hear.
We have very few payables. We're paying off our mortgage is greatly reduced. We're paying off all kinds of loans. And we've gotten a number of large grants recently for all of our programs. Our programs are doing well. Really, I think I would just call it growing pains. I mean, I think we looked for an executive director to lead the company. The person that we hired, for various reasons, I think not just one, didn't work out. I think the people who are leading the company now are actually the most experienced people. I was working as associate producer this year, so in terms of knowing what the season is and getting everything together, in terms of designers and actors and things, there was not even a hitch in terms of moving that along. Jonathan Croy, who is my co-artistic director, has also been with the company for 25 years. He works in the education program. We have a huge education program. And Steve Ball, who's the managing director now, has been the general manager for, I think, almost 27 years. Mm-hmm. So between the three of us, we've worked almost 100 years at the company. I don't think it could be in safer hands, really.
And that's very good to hear.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you see headlines in the newspapers, and it's probably pretty easy to write a headline about drama at a Shakespeare company, I suppose.
Of course.
I want to bring in Mary Claire Hulbert from Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival. So many, whether they're theater companies or performing arts organizations, are about the people, of course, and those people could live any place. They could work any place. Jacob's Pillow is interesting because it's a place first, and then it's a dance company. Can you explain a little bit about the history of the place and
sure.
the company?
Sure. So today, Jacob's Pillow is a National Historic Landmark. Just a few years ago, we received the National Medal of Arts from President Barack Obama. But 83 years ago, the festival was founded by a man named Ted Shawn, who was and is one of the founding fathers of modern dance. he was at a point in his life where he wanted to pursue this dream, this mission he had had for a very long time, to legitimize the art of dance as a career for men. He had long wanted a company of men dancers. He was already an established, you know, dance legend at the time. He had been in Massachusetts. He had been in Beckett, Massachusetts, and was looking for a retreat in order to pursue this mission. And he happened upon this abandoned farm in Beckett, which was already named Jacob's Pillow at the time, and fell in love with it and bought the farm, and then assembled this group of very, very talented men dancers who then used that space as a retreat to create work. They built many of the buildings that we still work in today at the Pillow, and they would give small performances for the people that lived in the area. So it started off, it didn't start off as a festival, it started off as a place to create work. And then slowly neighbors started to be very interested, and Ted Shawn would give lecture demonstrations where he would talk about the art of dance. At the time, there were not necessarily lectures. Dance was not something that people learned in universities. People did not really know that there were ways of making choreography and that it was an art form in that way. When many of those men dancers were drafted, Shawn started to invite other colleagues in the dance field to come and perform, and that is in essence how the festival was born. So today, we still carry through a lot of that feeling of community and sharing. Every single summer, we have more than 350 free and ticketed performances, talks, exhibits, classes. More than half of those offerings are completely free. We always say you don't need a ticket to visit the Pillow. Sometimes folks say, oh, well, do I need to buy a ticket to the shows in the theaters in order to explore the grounds and enjoy free things? And absolutely not. Anyone is welcome at any time. We have, you know, beautiful art and photography exhibits. We have talks throughout the entire festival. And dance companies from around the world come every single summer to come and share what they do best with all of our audiences.
You know, we're obviously in Connecticut very familiar with Palabolas and in Washington, Connecticut, and the way in which they've sort of pushed the limits of the human body in dance. And that's something that I associate too with the work at Jacob's Pillow, that there's this sense that, much like what you're talking about with the way you push Shakespeare and the language in these works, you really are pushing at the edges of choreography, no matter who you're bringing in. That seems to be part of the through line of what you do.
Our mission is to push the boundaries of what is considered to be dance and to show the depth and the breadth of what the art form can be. So you wouldn't go to a heavy metal concert and consider that the only kind of music that there ever was. And
I know people who would.
Well, some would.
But
there are some, you know, we want to kind of expand the public view of dance, and that it's not just ballet, it's not just pointe shoes, it's not just Palabolas. Palabolas does wonderful, wonderful work. So our mission is to bring as many kinds of new dancers and new choreographers as possible. We present hip hop, we present tap dance, we present very classical ballet, we present very adventurous dance theater. Some things that some people may have a little question mark and say, is that dance? So that's what we like to talk about, and it's kind of push the boundaries of what people consider dance to be.
Now, so Jeremy, what's interesting about your organization, the Norman Rockwell Museum, is there's nothing more quintessentially American than Norman Rockwell, right? I mean, and people think they know everything about him because they have these iconic images in the head.
And Rockwell was a heck of a dancer.
He liked Shakespeare, too.
I'm sure he was, and I'm sure he loved Shakespeare as well. But I want to talk a bit more about what the Rockwell Museum is, but maybe you can pick up on this thought about how you work on pushing the edges of what people might know about Rockwell or with some of the other programming that you do, because I think if people go to your museum thinking it's just going to be a slice of Americana, they'd probably be in for something a little bit different.
Well, yeah, I think that people have an impression of Norman Rockwell. And I guess as far as pushing the edges, we're trying to make people aware of all aspects of this artist. And within the field of the illustration arts, which is essentially what he did, he was a commercial artist. So many of his paintings were actually, you know, dictated, you know, by the, you know, what was fitting for the publication at the time. Now, actually, interesting, when he moved to Stockbridge, he had sort of a, his worldview expanded. He had a much more, maybe a forum that he found to explore some issues that he was very concerned about, civil rights. He actually painted the United Nations, and this has kind of like it broadened his scope. He found a way to kind of get beyond the next everyday scenes of, you know, that we're familiar with, which people love. But I think for our museum, we're definitely trying to make people aware of all of his many interests and his real humanitarian efforts. We're actually just about to open a very exciting show at the United Nations headquarters in New York to commemorate their 70th anniversary. So we'll be having a original work that he did to depict this peacekeeping organization. It later became the Golden Rule, which actually is a huge mosaic in the United Nations. It's a very interesting story, the way that whole, sort of exhibit came to be, you know, but we could probably take another hour to talk about that. But just to answer your question, I think that we definitely would like to share the art that's around us every day, you know, not only Rockwell, but illustration. We're opening, just about to opening a show of Roz Chast, who's a cartoonist many people are probably aware of for the New Yorker magazine.
Well-known cartoonist, yeah, that should be fun.
And I think it's just looking at work that maybe people would not think about as art. You know, it's seen in magazines and people love it, but I think it's seeing it in a different context is often very enlightening.
A little later on in the program, we're going to be talking with folks from the W.E.B. Du Bois homestead here. An important thing to note, the Rockwell Museum, as it sits now, it's not a homestead. This is not going to Norman Rockwell's home. His studio, though, sits on the grounds, these beautiful grounds that you can wander. Explain to people what you'll see there, because you can actually walk through the place where he created art.
Yeah. Well, I will take you back just because a similar story to my friends here, that the Rockwell Museum actually started it as an effort to save a historic building in town called the Old Corner House. This is 1969, and Rockwell had loaned some of his paintings to have a sort of a town museum. It ended up that people were understanding that this original artwork was here, coming in droves, and the historic building relocated. We moved in, and it really became the Norman Rockwell Museum solely at that point. We moved because we literally were crowded out of that space, and when we relocated to our current site in the early 90s, we have the opportunity on this long estate that we have the museum located on now to bring his original studio from town. We put it in a flatbed truck, moved it, and reassembled it on the site. And so that is something that is a very unique, you know, not many artist studios that you can actually visit, you know, through a museum and see, you know, you really feel like you're there where he did all of his iconic works.
We're talking with Jeremy Clove from the Norman Rockwell Museum and Mary Claire Hulbert from Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival, Ariel Bach, who's from Shakespeare and Company. We're in the Berkshires today. We're celebrating the Berkshire International Film Festival and also all the things that happen in this beautiful part of the world here on Where We Live. When we come back, we're going to meet the executive director of the Mahewy Theater. They're hosting us for today's program. We're also going to be talking with folks from the W.E.B. Du Bois homestead, of course, the great civil rights leader who made his home right here in Great Barrington. When we come back from break, we'll be talking more about collaboration amongst all these great arts institutions as we broadcast live from the Berkshires here on Where We Live. Live from the Mahewy Performing Arts Center in downtown Great Barrington, Massachusetts. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're broadcasting along with the Colin McEnroe Show live from the Berkshires today. Colin has for years been coming to the wonderful Berkshire International Film Festival, and we thought, it's just so nice here this time of year. Why don't we bring our show up here and spend the day? And we're really glad we did. We're visiting with folks from some of the amazing cultural institutions that are all knitted together in this beautiful part of the world. And we'll be getting more to them in just a moment. But I want to welcome in Beryl Jolly, who's executive director of the Mahewy Performing Arts Center, hosting us today. Thank you so much for having us and for coming on the show.
We're so glad you could come. Thank you.
Can you tell us about this theater? It is a perfect little place, and it's a vaudeville theater, and there's a lot of theaters like this all over America and all over New England, but few, I must say, are redone so beautifully as this. Can you tell us a little history?
Absolutely. This theater is 110 years old this year. It was built in 1905 by a contingent of local businessmen after a fire had been on this area. It's actually part of the entire Mahegui block is one continuous building, but the theater is intact on its own. And today, actually, May 29th marks the 10th anniversary of when we restored the theater and celebrated with a centennial celebration 10 years ago today. Hugh Hardy was the architect who helped us oversee this restoration, who is an esteemed architect, Radio City Music Hall, so many beautiful theaters in New York City. So we were blessed to have his talents oversee this restoration. And it is acoustically quite perfect and a beautiful gem. When people see concerts or live performance or movie screenings here, it's really a special, intimate experience.
So right now, you're a big part. You're one of the main presenting spots for the Berkshire International Film Festival, which just started yesterday, right?
Exactly. And the film festival is also celebrating its 10th anniversary. Kelly Vickery and her team have done an incredible job with that over the last decade. And so it's a nice synergy that we're all celebrating so many special anniversaries right at this time.
But the nice thing about this is you can show movies here. It's a great space for movies, but you do performing arts, you do music, you do dance, you do all sorts of things.
We're a little bit like the cornucopia of the Berkshires. I like to think that we have a little bit of that bounty, and we're just a gateway into all the other beautiful and amazing cultural opportunities throughout the area.
But before I let you go, I just have to ask you, because we were talking about this beforehand, if people have been to Great Barrington or been through Great Barrington and into other parts of the world, they may remember this beautiful little town. Well, right now, there's a little bit of construction in town, but I think we can both say you can actually come to Great Barrington right now and you can park your car. A couple weeks ago, it was touch and go.
We encourage everyone to come to Great Barrington and park your car and visit the local businesses. The construction is almost winding down just in time for the summer. They've done an excellent job, and there's definitely parking throughout the downtown area.
I really appreciate you having us, and I appreciate you being part of this film festival that we love so much. And, Beryl, thanks very much for being on the show.
Thank you, and there's a lot to see all year round.
Yeah, and absolutely. You know, it's not just the summertime here, but, of course, the summertime is such a great time. Ariel, maybe I can start with you, and you can all pick up on this. This idea of collaboration between these institutions, we're so close. These towns, Lenox and Lee, North Adams is just up the street in Williamstown. I mentioned at the start of the show these amazing cultural institutions. You're all within maybe an hour drive, 20 minutes drive, 10 minutes drive of everyone. How do you work together?
Well, it depends. Sometimes we have marketing initiatives or something that everyone participates in, because I think that we all recognize that when the Berkshires is busy, that helps each one of us. And other times it's very specific. We collaborate with the Women's Action Movement Theater. We hosted their show this fall. We also worked developing one of the shows we're doing this year, Mother of the Maid, was originally read as part of the Berkshire Playwrights Lab last year. So it's kind of a lot depends on what you want to do and who you happen to be, you know, talking to about it.
Well, I do think, too, and this happens in cities an awful lot, you have cultural institutions that do work together, mm-hmm. but are also, you know, you're after the same donors, and sometimes you're looking to do shows in the same nights. There does feel like there's a different spirit of collaboration here than in some urban areas. I could just be wrong. This could be my Pollyanna view of how lovely it is up here, but I mean, is there something to that, do you think?
I would say it has to do a lot with the folks that are attracted to the Berkshires are cultural consumers and lovers of culture in general. And so I think many of the folks that come to Jacob's Pillow also go to Shakespeare and Company and also go to many of the museums. And if someone enjoys art, then we would love for them to go to our cultural colleagues as well, because the more you know about different kinds of art forms, the more it enriches other art forms. I mean, dance is not just dance. It doesn't live in a bubble. We, you know, Marge Champion, who is one of our wonderful donors and was a wonderful dancer in film and movies when she was a young woman, was also the animation model for Snow White, for the animated film Snow White. So when Norman Rockwell had an exhibit about Disney's Snow White a few years ago, Marge Champion was also part of that. So there's so many threads and through lines, and so much of dance has crossover with theater, and so much of dance has crossover with design and art and fashion and music. And so none of these art forms exist kind of in its own little bubble, and there's so much crossover naturally.
It's true for the patrons, mm-hmm. and it's completely true for the artists, and especially the artists who choose to live here year-round. I think we all love to see each other's work. I mean, I'm so excited to see Roz Chast cartoons, and I hope that Jeremy is going to be so excited to see Comedy of Errors.
Absolutely. Well, I'm a big theater fan, but I think that when you, it's just a great area. I think it represents the artist, mm-hmm. because an artist is informed by, you know, as you said, they don't live in a bubble. So, you know, when you have Al Hirschfeld designing your works, and a very well-known illustrator who's been a friend of our museum in the past, he looks to dance, he looks to the theater people of the world for his subjects. Rockwell, you know, looked at musicians and other people that ended up in his work, you know, and I think the Berkshires is a great summation of that. Not only the arts, but also the nature, the beautiful thing I think what attracts so many working artists to this area is the scenery. You can, just down the street from our museum, you could take a hike up Monument Mountain where Herman Melville created the book Moby Dick. You know, he was inspired by the book to create that book. So I think this is there is a vibrancy out here. You feel it, you know, when you drive through here. I mean, that was my mm-hmm. first impression of the Berkshires when I came out this way.
But that's also one of those balances, right? The place is made to be this scenic vista, and it draws artists, and then artists bring more artists. But then the more people you bring, of course, that's great. And then there's the issues with that, too. I mean, do you ever feel the pressures of expansion, the pressures of modernization, the pressures of encroachment of suburbia?
As I mentioned before, we obviously did. We had to expand. We literally, it was public demand. We didn't have room to accommodate people that would come through this small historic house and look at artwork of Rockwell. So I think I think the Berkshires listens to its visitors. We obviously very dependent on tourism. So, and luckily there's the space to do that. I mean, that's a really unique thing about this area, that there does seem to be additional areas to branch out and still maintain that aesthetic, that look of what you come here for.
A lot of what is special, I think, about this region and a lot of the culturals in the area is that sense of intimacy. And so it's very important for all of us, I think, to be very authentic and stay true to our mission and to what made us and makes us special. At the Pillow, our theaters are a 600-seat theater and a 200-seat theater. And that intimacy is one of the beautiful, beautiful parts about coming to Jacob's Pillow and walking around and being able to be in the same breathing space as the dancers. And it's not a 3,000-seat theater. If we, you know, we sell out many performances, could we build a much larger theater? Sure. But that may impact then the intimacy of the space and the fact that the studios where the dancers rehearse are within walking distance and the doors are open and people can come and peek their heads in and you, they're living there often while they're performing. So you see them after the show. And
well, and I think that's the key, whether or not it's speaking Shakespeare without microphones into the open air, or going to, whether it's the Pillow or to Tanglewood, mm-hmm. and literally peering into these practice rooms and seeing these young musicians working at their craft, that's one of the things. It's literally up in your face, mm-hmm. in a way that you don't get so many other places.
You have contact with the artists all the time. They're walking in your town. They're walking, you know, they're in your laundromat. They're mm-hmm. next to you at the restaurant. I think that's one of the great things about the Berkshires and about coming here.
But it's also, it seems as though the artists welcome it. It's not,
absolutely.
I've never run into anyone here who says, oh my goodness, I wish I just had some space away from all these peering
eyes.
It's a
bit like everyone's on vacation in a way, except we're all working.
You're all working very, very hard. Well, before we run out of time, since you're all working very hard, I mean, Ariel, tell us about some things that are happening this summer, if you'd like to, at Shakespeare and Company. What can we expect to see?
Well, we're just opening our first show this weekend. We had previews last weekend, The How and the Why by Sarah Treem. And then our main stage show, Shakespeare, is Comedy of Errors this year, and it should be a wild and wonderful total experience. And then we're also doing Henry V as part of our history series. That's in our smaller theater, and it has a group of artists that have worked with the company for many, many years. So I expect that will be very moving and exciting at the same time. And then Red Velvet, which is a play. It's this is our first the first American production of Red Velvet, and our own John Douglas Thompson is playing the lead. It's about an African-American actor, Ira Aldridge, who was the first African-American actor to play the role of Othello, which had been traditionally performed by a white person. Mm-hmm. And what had happened, this was in the 1880s. I won't go on, but it's a wonderful and very sad story as well. And I think that's going to be something to see, a fantastic production. And then we have Hamlet over at the Mount this year. We have our production of Shakespeare and the Language That Shaped a World under the Rose Tent. Our fall show is an Iliad, which takes us into the land of Greek war, but also right up to the present day.
It's been a while since I've read the Iliad.
Come see this. It's interesting. We're doing a number of really wonderful, funny shows, and The Unexpected Man is another play that is. It's not funny like The Comedy of Errors is, but it's a wonderful two strangers on a train kind of interesting to see what happens. One of them is a big fan of the other, who's a famous author. We also have a serious side where we're doing plays that talk about war. Henry V, Cry Havoc is a play that was developed by one of our artists about a veteran, and it talks about veterans and their issues, and so does an Iliad, really.
And what we'll do, too, is we'll put on our website, WNPR.org, links to all these institutions. But, Ariel, thanks for sharing a little bit about Shakespeare and Company. It sounds like a wonderful season, a wonderful summer.
I'm so excited about it, yes.
And Mary Claire, you've got Ira Glass coming, don't you?
I'm so excited.
Right? Yeah. So, just so you know, I talked to Ira about the show when it was in New Haven. And he kept telling us that he didn't want anybody to think that he's actually dancing. But he's actually dancing, isn't he?
There might be a little surprise in there.
So this is the Ira Glass Show. Is it one act, three acts, four dancers?
Three acts, two dancers, one radio host. So Ira Glass, host and creator of This American Life, which I just absolutely adore, happened upon the work of Monica Bill Barnes, who is a choreographer and a dancer who has been called the Tina Fey of dance. And Monica's work, and Monica has performed at the Pillow before, is brilliant and witty and hilarious, but also cathartic and poignant. And a lot of those through lines are they have in common with This American Life. So Ira saw a performance of hers and really fell in love with her aesthetic and invited her to be part of This American Life Live, which I believe was screened here at the Mahawi a few years ago. And then they created their own show with dancer Monica Bill Barnes, which has been touring the country but has not yet come to the Berkshires. And so we are so thrilled to present it. It's June 13th and 14th. It's a special pre-festival engagement. And so it stars Monica, Anna, the dancers, and Ira Glass. And there are stories and there's dancing. And he's quoted in many of the materials as saying, you know, radio is all words, no movement, and dance tends to be all movement, no words. And so you would think these two things have no business being together. But the show, anyone I know who has seen the show has just been absolutely wowed. So we are so, so, so very excited. And that kind of kicks off the season for us. And then, as I mentioned, we have, you know, 50 dance companies coming from all over the world. And anyone can go to our website at jacobspillow.org to see the entire schedule and videos and information.
Well, and thank you so much, Mary Claire, and have a great season.
Thank you.
And it's great to meet you. And Jeremy, you mentioned some of the things that you have coming up. Roz Chast, opening a brand new show, the great New Yorker cartoonist. And tell us again very briefly about this thing that you're doing at the UN, because I think this is a really interesting, important story.
Yes. So actually, this is an exhibit that the UN learned about this picture, 1953 era drawing that Rockwell had created of the organization. It was actually newly founded at that point. And they learned about it through a video that we had on, I created actually, this little video of the painting. And they contacted us and they said, we have our 70th anniversary coming up and we would love to do a commemorative to get maybe this work on loan to us to view in time. Well, sure. We had the Deputy Secretary General visited the museum last summer and was delighted with Rockwell and his work. He's very, very supportive of this. And so this is becoming a reality. It's just really amazing. And it'll be open to the visitors of the UN in New York City, along with the Golden Rule painting that I
I talked about, you're speaking with Ray Gunn in just a few minutes. Some of his family are actually in that painting. They're a community of the Berkshires and actually Vermont, which is where he started the United Nations painting. They came together for this work, and now they'll be on view for the world in New York City.
And hopefully, you know, people will understand, you know, that this was, you know, the area that Rockwell created all this work in New York. And the Berkshires is not too far away, as it is from Hartford.
And of course, if you can't make it to the UN, there's lots to see at the Norman Rockwell Museum. And of course, once again, we'll put information on our website, WNPR.org. Jeremy, great to meet you, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Great to meet you.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to learn more about one of the residents of Great Barrington, Massachusetts, who put this place on the map, W.E.B. Du Bois, the great civil rights leader. We're going to meet with folks from the historic site for W.E.B. Du Bois in just a few minutes. We're broadcasting in the Mahewey Theater, a beautifully restored little theater right here in downtown Great Barrington, Massachusetts, where we're broadcasting live from the Berkshires today on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, the end of the state legislative session is drawing near, which means it's time for Where We Live to check in with state lawmakers. What's happened to all those bills we've been hearing about at the state capitol, and what's going on with the state budget? We'll catch up with some lawmakers coming up on Monday's show, and then hopefully you can join us Monday at 5 o'clock for the Wheelhouse Uncensored. It's a live version of the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Myself, Colin McEnroe, and a panel of reporters and experts having a lot of fun at Black Eyed Sally's in downtown Hartford. If you'd like to buy tickets, they benefit WNPR, and you can go online to WNPR.org to find them. Also, do not miss the Colin McEnroe show this afternoon at 1 o'clock. He and his team will be broadcasting live from the Berkshire International Film Festival at the Triplex Theater with a diverse panel of filmmakers, producers, and actors. That's what brought us to the Berkshires today and Where We Live. We're here as part of the Berkshire International Film Festival at the beautiful Mahewey Theater, which is right in downtown Great Barrington. We've been talking with cultural leaders, some of the great cultural institutions from around the Berkshires. And now we want to bring in David Glassberg and Ray Gunn. They're both involved in the W.E.B. Du Bois National Historic Site. This is a historic site for one of the great civil rights leaders in American history, who is from right here in Great Barrington. And I want to welcome you both to the show. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you very much.
David, and I know we were just, you were listening to the first little bit of our conversation, and we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things that make the Berkshires so special, and this idea that the Berkshires is not just what we think. It's all just New York transplants, and it's not just white folks from all over the Boston area. This is actually a very ethnically diverse place and a place that has a lot of history.
No, actually, I was thinking about a year ago, I was touring the Mount, Edith Wharton's house, and looking at the marble stonework that was done by the Italian Americans there and also many other places in the Berkshires. And you think about the fact that for many years, this district was represented by Silvio Conti, who was clearly the most popular Republican congressman, I think, ever in Massachusetts since the Civil War. You think about even Jacob's Pillow, and it was a place where the lumber for that was produced by Warren Davis, an African-American entrepreneur. So there's always been a very strong presence of people, African-Americans, Italian-Americans, Irish-Americans in the Berkshires that really laid the foundation for a lot of the cultural attractions that people can enjoy today.
Tell us about the W.E.B. Du Bois home site. Is this the place where he grew up in Great Barrington?
It's, as he termed it in a famous memoir, it's the first home that he remembered. Du Bois was born in Great Barrington near the Housatonic River, and there's actually a park in right by that birth site called the W.B. Du Bois River Garden, which is a wonderful place to visit, and it's celebrating, I think, its 20th anniversary as a park right now. And then when his father left around age 2, Du Bois and his mother moved to the family homestead that was in his mother's family, the Burkharts, for about 150 years. And this is the site that visitors can go to, and it's marked as the W.B. Du Bois boyhood home site, and it's a National Historic Landmark. It's about 2 miles outside of town, and he lived in that house with his grandparents and his mother for about 5 years, and then moved back into town with his mother, and they lived in a variety of different places in Great Barrington. Du Bois graduated from Great Barrington High School and then went on to Fisk University, Harvard, and his career.
Ray Gunn, your family has a very interesting connection, and I'm wondering if you can tell us about your family's connection to the historic site.
Oh, well, my family has been in Stockbridge, really, and my father, whose name was David L. Gunn, he became interested early on when Walt Wilson and Edmund Gorman Gordon first came into the area to investigate the Du Bois bringing up. Mm-hmm. And so they used to come into my house, our house in Stockbridge, which is on East Street, and they had meetings there, and then they would come down to Great Barrington and look at the site and find out the different places where Du Bois had lived, worshipped, and also spent a lot of time. So, yes, my father was involved early on, and he was also instrumental in setting up the first dedication of the areas that we are now talking about.
Mm. David, a lot of people in the last few years have obviously been thinking quite a bit, whether it's the film Selma or the commemoration of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. People have been talking about the civil rights movement of the 1960s more in the last few years than they have in quite some time for a number of different reasons. But maybe you can just tell us a little bit more about the importance that Du Bois had and how the civil rights movement that we ended up with in the 1950s and 60s actually sprung in many ways from the work that he did so many years prior.
That's absolutely true. When you walk in, our very first sign when you come to the site says W.B. Du Bois, architect of the modern civil rights movement. Mm. And Du Bois was a writer. He was born in 1868, came of age in the 1890s, and actually had written his first book on the suppression of the African slave trade, the second book on the Philadelphia Negro, and then his best-known book, Souls of Black Folk, which really talked a lot about the condition of African Americans. And there's a famous chapter in there where he takes on the leading African American leader of the day, Booker T. Washington, on the issue of whether or not there should be really accommodation to segregation in return for economic advancement. And Du Bois felt very strongly that there needed to be voting rights and full equality. And he and many other people went to Niagara Falls and created what became known as the Niagara Movement in 1905, and that movement ultimately wound up in the founding of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And Du Bois went on to be the editor of the journal The Crisis for really the next 20-some years and set the agenda for a lot of the civil rights work that was being done in the decades before World War II.
Ray, you must feel a great sense of pride to be so closely connected with this history.
Oh, I am. One of the things that has stood out in my mind back in those early days when I was much younger was the fact that my father was also always interested in civil rights here in the county. And here was a man, Du Bois, who spoke out, and he was looking for civil rights for all people, not just blacks, but also the other minorities that were around in the area. And so my father was instrumental in starting the local branch of the NAACP, which fit right in with the legacy of Du Bois. And so he worked very hard with Edmund Gordon and Walter Wilson in trying to develop the home site, the birthplace, and set up plans for doing future work for the Du Bois legacy here in Gray Barrington. But they wanted to be here in Gray Barrington because this is where he was born.
Hmm. You know, Jeremy from the Rockwell Museum mentioned this earlier, that your family also has some ties to Norman Rockwell.
Oh, well, yeah. And a little while ago, David mentioned the fact that Mr. Davis was the guy who got some of the lumber for Jacob's Pillow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was my uncle. So we sort of spread right out, and it seems ironic that all these things do come together. So we were involved in a lot of the paintings at the Norman Rockwell Museum. In fact, the one that's going to be presented,
this is the painting at the UN.
Painting at the UN, right. Yeah. That painting will have my father in it, will have my late brother in it, David, and it will have my sister-in-law in it. So those are just some of the other things that this family is involved with coming out of Stockbridge. And by the way, my father and Norman were very good friends, and they used to ride bicycle in Stockbridge.
They used to ride bikes together. That's amazing, and that's really it's an amazing piece of history, and it all ties to, it's sort of what we were talking about earlier in the conversation too. All these organizations built over quite some time, artists coming to this area, working with craftspeople who helped to build things, and I don't know, David, really knitting together this community. And I'm glad we were able to bring it to this idea of Du Bois and the diversity of this area too, because it is not something people think of when they think of the Berkshires, but this is an important history.
No, and there's a lot of surprises, you could say. In fact, the Du Bois home site is not only place in Berkshire County that's dedicated to African-American history. There's a African-American Heritage Trail where you can go to Pittsfield and see the home of Samuel Harrison, who is the chaplain for the Massachusetts 54th, which was the all-black regiment that fought during the Civil War. Or you could go to Sheffield and see the home of Colonel John Ashley, whose enslaved servant, Elizabeth Freeman, was one of the first people to sue for her own freedom.
Hmm.
And so this is a history that goes way back.
Yeah.
And there are many places to visit in the Berkshires to see that history.
I'll just ask you a last, Ray. We just have a minute or so left, but how do you feel when you see all these people gathering together in this town for a film festival or anything else, everyone flocking to this wonderful little town to just enjoy all the things we've been talking about? How does it make you feel as a resident?
It puts me in a funny situation, to tell you the truth. How do you handle this? It's like, I know when I'm at the Norman Rockwell Museum and it's my son that's in the painting of New Neighbors. And when he is there and I am there and we've got a group around us, it's like, ooh, you know, everyone is mystified, so to speak. But even down here when we go out into the park and we're taking tours and we're saying Du Bois was here.
Yeah.
And also the church that Du Bois, one of the churches that he attended is the Clinton Amy Zion Church over here on Elm Street. And I'm a member of that, so it's sort of exciting.
It's exciting and a little bit of history all surrounding at the time.
A lot of times I say to myself, boy, I don't know if I can live up to this.
Well, Ray Gunn, you have certainly, from the WEB Du Bois National Historic Site Steering Committee, thank you so much for your time, sir. And thank you, David Glassberger, professor of history at UMass Amherst and a member of the Site Steering Committee. I want to thank the folks at the Mehewe Theater for hosting us today. Coming up at 1 o'clock this afternoon, the Colin McEnroe Show. We'll be back with all of our wonderful producers broadcasting live from the Berkshire International Film Festival at the Triplex Cinema just across town. Hope you enjoyed our day in the Berkshires here on Where We Live.